Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
And let's move now from the 18th century to more recent history of Boston. It's a collection of gritty photographs of the city from the post-World War II years through 1987. Back then, Boston was best known for its former greatness. It was a faded industrial port, very working class, and a little beaten down. In those days, the central artery wasn't being torn down and buried. It was being built up, cutting the city in two to help people escape to the suburbs. Jim Botticelli began the project as a Facebook page with a mishmash of old photographs that attracted a bit of a cult following. Then it caught the interest of a local publisher, and the result is a new book called Dirty Old Boston, Four Decades of a City in Transition. Jim Botticelli grew up in Lexington. He went to college at Northeastern, and he came in recently to talk about Dirty Old Boston with my co-host, Sasha Pfeiffer.
The way I got to know the city was when I went to Northeastern, and then when I taught, I started subbing in the Boston Public Schools, so I went to all the schools, Roxbury, Dorchester, Mattapan, Hyde Park, everywhere, and I got to know the city pretty well.
You know, even though the name Dirty Old Boston doesn't sound that appealing, in your case, it's actually a term of endearment, I gather.
Absolutely. Yeah, I hope people get that. I've had a few people complain about it, but I haven't had too many complain about it. I think most people get it.
And when you say they get it, what is it about calling the city Dirty Old Boston that's an embrace, basically, of what Boston used to be?
Well, you know the city from back in the day, right? You know, the trash was all over the streets. The returnable cans, they were thrown in the streets because nobody had to pay a nickel. It was a Pulp Fiction-y kind of place in retrospect. You know, I don't know if I recognized it at the time, but, you know, hindsight is 20/20, right?
But it's still a city that, even in its form back then, you still seem to really love and really wanted to have honored in a way with this book and these pictures.
Yeah, I'm a reluctant guy about moving forward.
You know, Jim, some of the pictures in this book, I just can't stop looking at them. I mean, and there's one that has such a funny caption. It's taken in the 1940s or 50s, and I'm not sure what street it is. I wondered if it was Hanover because there's a little pastry shop that almost looks like the sign above Modern, but it says double parked even then. And you see these like Model T type cars double parked in Boston. So this is not a new phenomenon.
Yeah, that's like 1945, but that was in the North End. Yeah, that was a prize find.
Another one that really made my jaw drop, I'm on page 15, is Magazine Beach in Cambridge. Now, this recently got a renovation. It has new grass. It's been spiffed up. But this picture shows a literal beach with people in bathing suits in the water and these massive gas tanks in the background. I don't think those are there anymore, right?
No. I'd never seen the gas tanks. Jimmy Seary from the Plow and Stars sent me that picture. And
the Plow and Stars bar between Central and Harvard Squares.
Yes, yes. He's the cook over there. Makes a good meal, too. A little plug for him. He sent me that picture, and so there it is.
So what do you think when you look at something like that?
I think, boy, I'd like to be back then swimming in the Charles River on Magazine Beach. You know, too bad we can't go in now.
Even though, I should note, the caption says, by the 1950s, swimming was banned because of all that dirty water, and there they mean it literally.
Right. Bill Weld went in, remember? Were you around
him?
He jumped in.
Sure, he jumped in the Charles.
He jumped in the Charles with all his clothes on. He must have had some of that amber-colored liquid that he was so famous for.
There's another photo in here that was so striking. Many people have heard the story of the new Hancock building that shortly after it was built, the glass panes began to fall off.
Yeah.
And had to be repainted. You have this great picture of the Hancock with plywood in a lot of its windows.
Yeah, they used to call it the Plywood Palace. They called it the Plywood Palace for years because it took them like 5 or 6 years to resolve the issue.
Yeah, that was a big deal.
The glass was popping.
Big, major mistake.
I don't know if anybody ever got hit, but, you know, people walked under that. And, you know, that's a wind tunnel down there. I'm sure you've been down there.
Absolutely. You know, there are a lot of pictures in here as well that you'd have to be a real old-timer to even remember this happened. I mean, I didn't know that the South End used to have a group of streets named after places in New York, Oneida and Troy and Madison Place, but you have pictures of them being completely razed.
That's a story that I learned by doing this page. I learned a lot by doing this page about Boston history, and the New York streets was a special tragedy because it happened in 1955. It happened before the West End, and the people were mostly immigrants and sons and daughters of immigrants. The city, from what I hear, from what I've researched online, turned the electricity off in the neighborhood to get the people out of there, raised it, And we do run one picture in there of the New York streets.
Besides those streets in the South End being razed, of course you talk about the razing of the West End and Scully Square, which is still painful for many people today. And you write
yes.
at one point in the book about the human cost of urban renewal. And these photographs really make that clear. People disrupted, leaving neighborhoods they loved and that their families had lived in forever.
Yeah, there are people apparently still angry about that displacement. You know, the West End today could be what the North End is. When you think about it, they were very similar neighborhoods, and it wasn't given a chance. And what's there now, really? It doesn't have that character that, I don't know.
Another thing that, of course, many people consider a mistake that's since been corrected is these incredible pictures you have of the central artery going up. I mean, this highway slicing in half downtown, these beautiful buildings that then have an elevated road next to them. You look at them and wonder, how could anyone have thought of the idea, let alone go forward with it?
Oh, and now it's gone. The way we looked at a city, at the city of Boston back in the 50s, it was a place to go and then leave. It wasn't a place to live. For some people, I don't know, people did live here, but I think a city was looked at as a place you went and did what you had to do, and then you got out and went back home.
You think the attitude was, who cares if we cut the city in half with a highway?
Yeah.
People are going to go home to the suburbs anyway?
I do. I mean, we have a beautiful waterfront, and for 50 years it was, you know, you couldn't see it. Remember Faneuil Hall opened in the 70s?
Mm-hmm.
Quincy Market?
Mm-hmm.
And then there was the big expressway right there, and you had to walk under it with the dripping water and everything to get over to the waterfront. We're in a new sensibility now, and urban dwelling has become chic in a way.
For people who didn't live here back then, it's a reminder that this used to be a much grittier place.
Yeah. So I wanted to get the pulpier side of Boston. That's really what I was doing, looking for the pulpier side.
You describe in the book this way. You say, a past where ordinary people lived their day-to-day lives in a challenging but still affordable city. It was a place where you could find a parking spot when you needed it, a city where you could own your home for about a quarter of your monthly take-home pay, a city where you didn't need a reservation to grab a bite and would probably rather spend a Saturday night on the front steps with your neighbors anyway. Does that reflect how you feel about Boston then versus Boston now, that something was lost in the process?
Yeah, I mean, we all look through rose-colored glasses at the past and remember the hazy, crazy days of yesteryear. At least I do.
Is it rose-colored glasses for you, though? At some level, do you acknowledge that it wasn't all good back then?
Yeah, nothing's ever... I mean, if I were in that moment now, would I think it was as good as I think it is subsequently? No, I'd probably be like, I don't like this either. I don't know.
For people who are new to Boston and are going to learn a lot by looking at this book, is there something you hope they take away from it as they look back to Boston of the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s?
Yeah, I hope they'll value the fact that this place has a long and rich history. One guy called it the smallest big city in the country. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's really true, but, you know, there's something very big city about it, and then at the same time, there's something very parochial about Boston. It's just a hard place to nail. You know, it's just like they'll always act like Bostonians, you know what I mean? You've always got that, and whatever that means to you. It's quite a place.
Jim, thanks for coming into the studio.
My pleasure. Thank you very much. It was really fun.
And you can see some of Jim Botticelli's old photos at radioboston.org. More ahead, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.